Good morning and welcome, and special welcome to anyone who might be joining us for the first time. It's a gray outside, but it's warm and bright in here. The journey of faith and life's journey itself is often spoken of as a journey home. It can mean many things within the context of our different beliefs. It can mean home to God, home to the Spirit, home to the earth. But today, especially with our focus on Buddhism, let's think of that journey as one of going home to who we really are, to our best selves, to the place in us that is the core of our being, to the place where the extraneous falls away, where we can find peace. The teachings of all the great faiths are important and are certainly guides to us. But ultimately, we are our own best guide on that journey of discovering the truth within ourselves. As Rick lights the chalice, I invite you to join in our unison words of chalice lighted, printed in your order of service. Be ye lamps unto yourselves, be your own confidence, hold to the truth within yourself as to the only lamp. On this Mother's Day, let us gather our thoughts in prayer. First, for our own mothers, not just the woman who gave us birth or adopted us, but for all women who gave of themselves so that as children we might grow in health, experience, and learning, who by loving us taught us to love. As grateful children, we pause today to express our thanks for those mothers still with us and to hold tight to those memories of our departed mothers who live in our hearts, particularly on this day. We pray for all mothers here in this room. May they enjoy good health and happy lives. May they have the wisdom of good parenting and the courage to continue on the path of unselfish motherhood. We pray for those women who are not mothers, for some of whom this day may be difficult. May we also affirm them for their unique value in our community. For those among us
who've been hurt or rejected by mothers or who may be estranged from them. We acknowledge their pain and we pray that they might find nurturing support from others. We too pray that forgiveness and reconciliation may someday come to their families. We pray particularly for mothers who are having a difficult time in our own community and throughout the world. For those who love their children but are finding parenting particularly difficult at this time. For those unable to provide proper food or shelter. For those mothers who are unable to give loving care. May we do all that we can to support them and lessen their burden so that all children may have both their physical and emotional needs met. May we work to guarantee that all women have a choice as to when and if to become mothers, never forcing motherhood on a girl before her time. Finally, may we prevent our prejudices from limiting the roles of motherhood. May we welcome a world where there is a great diversity of family relationships, where a child may be raised by a loving single parent or have two dads or two mothers. All this we ask in the midst of the creative spirit, which some call the best of human nature and others among us call of God, knowing that its fulfillment requires strength, courage, and commitment from us all.
Michelle's holding a statue, and I want you to know who it is. Wow, lots of hands. Right here. It's Buddha. You know, you can put him back, I think, so you don't have to hold him the whole time. He's very comfortable right over there. Do you know something? This week is his birthday, and that's celebrated in many parts of the world. Today I want to tell you about who this man was and why we call him Buddha. Well, he was born more than 500 years before Jesus was born, in a country that we now call Nepal, which is near India. His real name was Siddhartha Gautama. His father was the ruler of a small kingdom, and he had lots of money and nice things, so Siddhartha was raised with everything a child could want. He was a handsome prince of the kingdom. When he was born, a fortune teller was called by his father to come and tell what his son's future would be. The fortune teller said that it would either be that he would become the greatest spiritual leader of all time, or he would become the greatest emperor. Well, guess which one his father wanted him to be? Yes. His father did not think it was a good idea for him to become the greatest spiritual leader. He wanted him to be the greatest emperor. And he did everything he could to encourage his son so that Siddhartha would become that. And he was smart and handsome. And it seemed that he was looking like he was going to be that good emperor. His father also wanted him to be happy. And he made sure that he didn't see any sad things, like sick people or hungry people. He'd given an order to his troops that each time his son left the palace, guards were to go ahead and clear the road of any people who were sick, so his son didn't see them. But then one day, that order got ignored. The person who we've come to call the Buddha saw some things about the world. He saw a sick person, a very old person, a person who had died. And these upset him. And then he saw a monk who had given up all the comforts of life. The monk wandered without a home, and he ate very little, and he had nothing but the clothes that he was wearing. But he seemed very happy. Siddhartha wondered how he could be happy without all the nice things like he had. He kept thinking about the suffering of the people and how this man with nothing seemed happy. And one night he left his family and went in the woods to think. He took off his fine clothes and put on the clothes of a poor person. He studied with several religious teachers. He gave up everything and ate so little that he almost died. But this didn't make him happy either. He sat and thought about life under the tree for a long time. And then he began to see things clearly. He saw that both having everything in order to be happy, as well as giving up everything in order to be happy, was not going to work. He realized that if we are always trying to get more things and hold on to them, that we can't be happy. He also realized we have to have the important things that we do need. He taught a simple way for people to be happy. He recognized that everyone was connected. In order to be happy, we had to treat others and even treat ourselves in the right way. He had many followers of his teachings. And one day, one of them asked him, "Are you God?" And he said, "No." They asked him, "Are you an angel?" And he said, "No." They asked him, "Are you a saint?" And he said, "No." "Then what are you?" they asked. And he said, "I am awake." And you know what? That became his new name, because that's what the word Buddha means. I am awake. The Buddha is the one who woke up to see and understand things about how we should live our lives in order to find true happiness. So Buddhism, one of the great religions of the world, started because one man woke up. And one thing in Buddhism that's very important is meditation. And there's lots of different kinds of meditation. There's silent meditation, there's walking meditation, there's guided meditation with words, and sometimes those words are even in music. So today I'm inviting everyone to enter into a time of guided meditation in song. It's number 1031. It's the Buddhist text from the loving kindness meditation, and I want you to observe how it starts by being kind to yourself and then reaching out to others and then reaching out to everyone. So it starts from us, from yourself, and reaches out with love and kindness. We will sing this. You can probably just, may not even need the book to follow, but you may remain seated. Just listen as Mike and the choir guide us through and join in as you can, and then we'll observe some silence.
Thank you.
Wasn't it a treat to have them here at 9 o'clock this morning? You know, in this congregation, folks draw their spiritual grounding from many different traditions. For many, the practices and or the teachings of Buddhism are an important aspect of their Unitarian Universalist faith. In our worship together, we draw upon this Buddhist tradition from time to time, along with many other traditions. And on some Sundays, the sermon itself is more in the form of a Dharma talk than a traditional sermon, as was the one on perfectionism that I preached just a couple weeks ago here. And just as we have our roots in Christianity and Judaism, and just as we have incorporated the ideas of humanist philosophers and earth-centered spirituality, there too is a significant connection between Buddhism and Unitarian Universalism. It goes back a ways. In the mid-1800s, the Unitarian Elizabeth Palmer Peabody published the first Buddhist text to be printed in English. Emerson and Thoreau both incorporated Buddhist teachings in their spiritual writing, and the Transcendentalists as a whole were fascinated with Buddhism, even though their understanding of it was somewhat distorted. But in spite of misunderstandings, Buddhism became an increasingly influential force in Unitarianism and later in Unitarian Universalism. Today, many Unitarian Universalists practice the Buddhist spiritual discipline of Zen meditation, study the tradition's sacred texts, and some UUs even formally take the precepts to become Buddhists. For many years, there's been a very active Unitarian Universalist Buddhist fellowship within our greater denomination. This relationship between Unitarian Universalism and Buddhism has not been just a one-way flow. Yes, many Unitarian Universalists have discovered and been enriched by Buddhism. But many practicing Buddhists have also discovered Unitarian Universalism. They often come to us for liberal religious education for their children, for a kind of social engagement that is generally not available in most Buddhist practice centers, and to join with others in social justice work. There is a two-way flow of Unitarian Universalists or Universalism to Buddhism and Buddhism to Unitarian Universalism because they each satisfy needs not totally met by the other and because they share some common approaches to life, I think. I believe that at the heart of this compatibility is the emphasis that both Buddhism and Unitarian Universalism place on the individual's right to a free and responsible search for truth, and the values of self-reliance, self-understanding, and critical thinking. On a personal level, I've experienced this compatibility within my circle of ministerial colleagues. For many years, I was part of a Unitarian Universalist ministers group called the Peabody Group. Yes, named after that same woman who brought the first Buddhist text to us. This was a group of six ministers who gathered monthly to exchange ideas and essentially to help each other with sermons. And intentionally, we were diverse. Theologically, we embraced many different positions. And one member of the group was the Reverend James Ishmael Ford, who is the first person to be ordained both a Unitarian Universalist minister and a Soto Zen priest. And I'm certainly indebted to him and his little book, This Very Moment, for some of the ideas in this sermon this morning. In our service today, we can only touch on a few ways in which Unitarian Universalism and Buddhism come together. And I probably should begin with a caveat, especially for those of you who are both more well-versed with both the practice and the teachings of Buddhism than I am. I'm not going to attempt a complex discussion on the various forms of Buddhism or to even try to give an all-encompassing overview of the topic. But rather, I hope to focus on just a couple of aspects of Buddhism that I believe fit well within Unitarian Universalist framework. And for those of you who are or would like to explore Buddhism more, you might want to check out James's book. It's available through the UUA bookstore as a starting point anyway. As I mentioned earlier, our tradition was drawn to Buddhist thought quite early, during the 19th century. It seemed that it was more of a novelty form of intellectual enrichment rather than real engagement with the tradition then. However, as we entered the 20th century, and as the humanist movement grew in our denomination, so did the interest in Buddhism. In Buddhism, those religious humanists found an ancient religion that challenged the prevailing notion in the comparative study of religion. Here they found an authentic faith tradition that was not directly concerned with the question of God or gods. Here instead was a concept of a non-theistic religion largely based on a popular Unitarian idea of radical self-reliance. Moreover, in its approach to the world, Buddhism, like humanism, has an emphasis on the here and now. Perhaps you may have heard the rather strange Buddhist proverb or saying, if you meet the Buddha on the highway, kill him. Humanist Unitarian Universalist minister Edward Erickson, in referring to that proverb, states, the harsh maxim drives home a vital truth. No holy prophet, Messiah, Christ, avatar, or even great God in heaven can do your spiritual or ethical work for you. Free yourself. Be a lamp unto your own salvation. For many humanists, although devoted to reason and scientific inquiry, there was still something missing. As one humanist put it, reason alone is just too short of a ladder to truth's full heights. In the practice of Zen meditation, people found a religious practice that did not start with a submission to dogma which they had rejected or found questionable, but rather focused on a spiritual emptying of those forces in your life which brought you pain and a connecting with your authentic inner being. The meditative practice of Zen provides an authentic spirituality for many humanists to discover the full height of truth and to integrate their inner and outer world. But it's not just humanists, and certainly not just Unitarian Universalists for that matter, who have begun to engage Buddhism. Today, many theists and Christians, both within our denomination and beyond, are avid Zen practitioners and embrace many Buddhist tenets as well. In his book, Ford tells of a Catholic Zen practitioner who, when asked how he could possibly be both, replied in this fashion. He first held out his hand, palm side up, and said, Catholic. And he then turned his hand over and held it out and said, Zen. In other words, the hand, though seen differently, was whole each time. Ford describes that as the embrace of two 100%. And indeed, I've learned that there are Zen practitioners and many religious traditions besides our own that find that compatibility as well. Many Unitarian Universalists connect to Buddhism primarily through this practice of Zen meditation, the regular practice of presence and attentiveness that allows us to go deeper into ourselves with the hope that, to some degree, we will awaken that Buddha mind within us, which will help us to reshape our own approach to life. However, it's not just through the practice of meditation that Unitarian Universalists embrace Buddhism. I personally find Buddhism's greatest contribution to Unitarian Universalism in its ethical teachings. Buddhism brings a profound interpretation of many of the same principles to which we ascribe as Unitarian Universalists. In the Buddha's very first sermon, known as the Sermon at Benares, we meet a man who has been troubled by that pain I talked about in the children's message. This pain and suffering can come from both indulgence and deprivation. He sees suffering as all-pervasive in our lives, but as he reflects on this suffering, he concludes it is real, but that it is a symptom. And then he approaches this pain in the same way a physician would approach your report of pain in your body. The Buddha proceeds like a doctor to diagnose the cause of the symptom. In Buddhist terminology, the cause is tanha, the drive for private fulfillment. And the prognosis is good. There is a prescription that will treat the symptoms. It's not the quick fix of a pill. It's more like physical therapy or athletic training. It's a regimen that must be followed, which is known as the Eightfold Path. As you'll see, the Eightfold Path has a great deal in common with the Unitarian Universalist principles that we affirm and promote. It consists of right views, right intent, right speech, right conduct, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right meditation. And these eight steps are often divided into three groups or independent aspects of enlightenment: morality, meditation, and wisdom. We have already briefly focused on meditation, and I wish to spend the remaining part of the sermon on the moral teachings found in the Eightfold Path, because this is where Buddhism most resonates for me. These moral teachings give us a way to take hold of our lives and to focus on how we relate to others. The Eightfold Path is a step-by-step approach of living in right relationship with ourselves, with those around us, and with our world. And of course, that's the core message of our Unitarian Universalist principles. We began on the path with the wisdom of the Four Noble Truths, acknowledging that suffering is real and it's the product of both excessive indulgence and attachment to material things of the world and the product of deprivation of basic things that we do need for life. To follow this path, you must first decide that you want to live your life differently. You have to want to free yourself from some of the distractions and to liberate yourself from the clutter in your life. The starting point for the Buddha is the recognition that the power of our mind is what shapes our lives. The Buddha once said, "All we are is the result of what we have thought." For the Buddha, it is not sin that we are to overcome in our lives, as is the case in many religious traditions, but it is ignorance. The Buddha wants to liberate us from the mechanical, thoughtless approach to life and instead lead us to a life that is continually self-examined. As Socrates, who was actually more or less a contemporary of the Buddha, said, "An unexamined life is not worth living." The Buddhist moral teachings are highly relational. Our individual path to enlightenment only comes about by being in right relationship to our world, to ourselves, to those around us. Our Unitarian Universalist principles, which proclaim respect for the interdependent web of existence, the dignity of every individual, and compassion in human relationships, to name a few, as you see, are embedded in this Eightfold Path. The Buddha gives us very practical steps to follow in order to live in right relationship with others in the world and thereby live in that right relationship to ourselves. It is in the way that we interact with others that our own destiny is determined. We must practice right speech, right conduct, right livelihood, and all these will require right effort. First, we must think about what our speech is revealing about our character. We should think about how often we find it necessary to deviate from the truth. But it's not just truth that should come from our lips, but also kindness and charity. You know, there are the obvious lies and gossip, But right speech is much more than just avoiding these things. It's equally important to avoid the ways we belittle people or the tactless ways we express ourselves that are damaging to others and to ourselves as well. If I might marry our principles once again to the Eightfold Path, we should regularly ask ourselves such questions as, did I speak in a way that honored the inherent worth and dignity of the person to whom or about whom I was speaking? That's no easy task to follow on a day-to-day basis. But by focusing on our speech, we can become more aware of what it may be revealing about our character and then work towards that practice of right speech. But it's not just our words that were the moral concern of the Buddha. We're instructed that we are to live, if we are to live the Buddha life, we must examine our actions and redirect them where necessary. You know, one tool to do that is what the Buddhist counterpart to the ethical half of the Ten Commandments. They're called the five precepts, and they direct us to do not kill, do not steal, do not lie, do not be unchaste, do not take drugs or drink intoxicants. But it's not just observing a negatively worded series of prohibitions that will lead us to right conduct. Our actions, like our speech, need to be directed at fostering the good in ourselves and in others. Our actions, like our words, must demonstrate justice, compassion, and truth. The Buddha encouraged us to engage in those activities and occupations that promote life rather than harm or destroy it. His realization that our jobs occupy most of our time is just as true now as it ever was, maybe more so. And therefore, examining the way we make our livelihood is one of the moral considerations in the Eightfold Path. In a world of multi-layered corporations and the need that all of us have to have a job that will provide us and our families with support, this can be a particularly difficult moral tenet to apply. But the Buddha tells us that we cannot make spiritual progress if the majority of our day is spent moving in another direction. The Buddha once wrote, "The hand of the dyer is subdued by the dye in which he works." I personally know that this is true from my own journey as I moved and from a life colored first by my job as an assistant district attorney and later as a criminal defense lawyer and then finally to ministry. And I also know how difficult it is to make changes, particularly from a job that provides well. I've done that. I'm not suggesting that you up and leave your job for a career that the Buddha would view as more appropriate, although I know some of you, in fact, have done that. But I am suggesting that we all examine our jobs and especially how we do them and see where we can apply more of this teaching. Finally, the Buddha recognizes that both the thoughtfulness and actions required on the Eightfold Path demand tremendous effort and dedication. Indeed, one of the steps is called right effort. The Buddha, speaking to a group of monks, put it this way: "Those who follow the way might well follow the example of an ox that marches through the deep mire carrying a heavy load. He is tired, but he is steady, but his steady forward-looking gaze will not relax until he comes out of the mire. Only then does he relax. O monks, remember that passion and sin are more than the filthy mire, and you can escape misery only by earnestly and steadfastly persevering in the way." The effort to follow the moral teachings of Buddhism is substantial. But every right thought, right word spoken, right action is a step along the way. Every moment spent in examining the way we live and relate to others is a step towards happiness and peace. On this path, we move away from anger and hostility, We crave less the material things of the world. We have greater compassion for others. And we increasingly recognize our interconnectedness, not just to other people, but to all creation. So, as we encounter the winds of change in our lives, the demands, disappointments, the confusion, the grief that will come, the Buddha says, know that there is a prescription for the pain. Go deep in right meditation, right thought, right mindfulness, and walk with steady effort on the path of right conduct, right speech, and right livelihood. It is said that no one except the Buddha has reached the full enlightenment of the journey, but each step along the way brings its measure of peace and joy. Our words of benediction are adapted from the Bodhisattva vows. May all sentient beings be well and enjoy the root of happiness, free from suffering and the root of suffering. May they not be separated from the joy beyond sorrow. May they dwell in spacious equanimity, free from craving, fear, and ignorance.